Welcome to Talks Around a Farm Table, a podcast about the diverse landscape of agriculture on Kodiak Island. This series is driven by Kodiak Soil Water Conservation District in collaboration with KMXT Radio. I am your host, Ian Zacher. Hello, gardeners, farmers, ranchers, and horticulturalists. On today's episode, we'll be diving into seed starting, growing in small spaces, and the importance of composting. Today's guest is a longtime Kodiak resident, known for her weekly columns in the Kodiak Daily Mirror, a YouTuber, and a bit of an island celebrity, Marion Owen. Thanks for coming on the show. Tell us a bit about yourself and how you came to growing in Kodiak.
Oh, how I came to Kodiak, for one thing, is back in the late 70s. And in the 80s, I used to work on research ships. So I was kind of a biologist, but I ended up becoming a mate, you know, one of the officers. But I loved coming to Alaska, and it didn't take me long as we went from port to port, in and out of research segments. I came to Kodiak. I went, oh, this is it. But that's not until I had kind of interviewed or checked out the other ports, like in Southeast Alaska. We went way out the Aleutian Chain up to the Bering Sea and Chukchi Sea, but here, this was it. The people were the friendliest. The hiking was the best. And I loved the animals and the birds. And even though it didn't have much flat space, here's what happened, Ian, is I was working on a tugboat at the time. We were tied up at one of the fuel piers here. And I was getting a little tired of going to sea because I was missing the seasons. You know, I'd go from summer, be gone for months, come back, and it'd be fall colors. I go, I don't want to do this anymore. So there I was, standing on the fantail or the stern of a tugboat, and I had to go to the doctor, and I'm looking up at the scenery, and I'm going, this is so beautiful here. I don't want to miss this anymore. And I said to myself, conversation with myself, what do I want to do? Two things popped in my mind. One was photography, and the other was gardening. Both of which kind of shocked me because I knew nothing about gardening. I didn't know anything until I came to Kodiak. Talk about a proving ground, right?
This is definitely a testing ground for sure. Oh. Yeah. Interesting note, I also was working several years when I first came up to Alaska as a research on a research vessel for the Forest Service.
Oh, for the Forest Service.
Yeah, I was a biological scientist crew lead for the FIA, Forest Service. Yeah. So what we would do is that we would live on a boat for all summer and then go out on a helicopter. The helicopter lived with us on a boat, and we would take the helicopter out and do forest inventory. And then we'd come back every night on the boat and then kind of puddle from Ketchikan all the way back up to Homer. And then we'd cut across to Kodiak every other year.
Yeah. Well, from there, having this aha moment of gardening, the year I moved here, which is 84, and then 85, I decided to start my own vegetable garden. And I would ask around, you know, talk to the locals. But most of the response was, well, we don't really grow many vegetables here, which was kind of surprised me.
That's the response.
It was a lot of flowers. It was a lot of flowers. And yet you look at historical photographs of Kodiak, and there was more of a need then, back in the day, where you really had to. And the photographs, you know, everybody's houses had plots. But I remember talking to Peggy Dyson, who passed on last year, and she remembers being here and ordering all of their groceries in one fell swoop to come up on the ship. So you had to order a year's worth of groceries at one time. Now, how many of us can do that?
Not with some efficiency, that's for sure.
Correct. Yeah. And she remembers seeing like the first oranges, the first whatever, you know, produce. So I decided, okay, well, I'm just going to do it anyway. I did research I could pre-internet, and I started in my laundry room under lights, a whole host of vegetables, you know, flowers and herbs. And then come May, it was a beautiful day in May. And I took my seedlings outside.
A rare day.
a rare sunny day in May. I didn't know at the time that's not when you want to transplant seedlings outside, is on a sunny day. Good for humans, bad for plants. I didn't know that then. So I took my trays and I set them out on the the raised bed, edges of the raised beds, and I just started putting them all out there in pretty local soil. Well, that night, a gale blew up, and the rain just like scraped across the garden, came out last.
There's the bay we know and love.
Yeah, yeah. And so the next morning, I mean, they're all flattened. All these seedlings are flattened like wet spaghetti. And I wanted to sit in my sorrow. But more than that, I wanted to grow my own vegetables. Okay. So I knew it had something to do with the soil. And this kind of segues into composting a little.
Yeah.
I knew it had something to do with soil. At least I knew that much. So I called the Extension Service in Anchorage, and I said, "Hi, my name's Marion Owen, and I live in Kodiak, and I really want to learn how to make compost. We got to have compost." And the lady on the other end, I'll never forget her voice and her tone and everything. She was so sweet. She says, "Oh, honey, that'll take you 5 years."
That is generally
I went, 5 years? This is February, and I wanted to eat lettuce in June.
Yeah.
So I went to the library. I tootled on over to our library, pre-internet, remember, and I started pulling down books. And they have a very good gardening section, by the way, in our local library. And this one book came out about soil or compost or something. It talked about the method developed in southern India. And I went, well, if I no harm in trying. So I collected, it was snowing and blowing for a couple of days. I went out to the beach and I cut down the beach ryegrass. I talked to friends who had horses, hence a lot of poop. Whatever I could find in February. And I put it all together using pallets as my sides for a compost bin. I built it all at once. And I don't know if I said a prayer or what, but the next couple days later, I go out there and I'm wearing Carhartts. I got a pink scarf around my neck and I got my pitchfork in hand. I could have been a postage stamp, you know. And I started turning it, and I tell you what, it was steaming. And I didn't have a thermometer then, but it was hot. And I was so ecstatic. I jumped up and down. I fell over on my Khadizer. Mm-hmm. But I knew I had something. I was so excited. And I haven't stopped since. That was 40 years ago. So I started over with the seeds, and now I've learned a lot, let me tell you.
Yeah, that is absolutely fascinating to hear about how early, how far Kodiak has come in the last 40 years in terms of producing food. But, you know, I work a lot with the villages and the village tribes and everything, with the village farmers. And, you know, the one of the things that I keep getting told is that this idea of growing our own sustenance has skipped a generation, so that they remember their grandparents having a garden, like in Porch Lions, they remember all the grandparents having their own garden, but that the generation that came after decided to either A, go find work elsewhere, and so they left the villages, and that the generation didn't kind of pick up those customs and those ideas, and that there is an idea that they are trying to reclaim a lot of that lost knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
And that's I find that to be, because you do see, like, in the pictures in the old Kodiak history books, like from the first time the Russians came and colonized here, that they had lots of agriculture here. They grew lots of food here. And it's not so much today.
Right.
It's not the case today. And I think that one of the hallmarks is that it is tough here to grow, isn't it?
It is tough.
Yeah.
It is. It's not easy. But talking with gardeners, I talk to gardeners every 2 weeks. I have a group of gardeners. We get on Zooms, and from New Zealand to Chicago, and there's no perfect place forever. There's always something a little off on the soil or the weather or the sunshine or the something.
Yeah, there's a little bit of work you got to put into
it. There's a little bit of,
yeah.
Yes. But if you start listening and, trying to make the effort to figure it out, like hoop houses. Now, when I first came here, you referred to the villages. I did a lot of work for Alaska Magazine and Associated Press. So I was mostly doing photography and writing pieces for magazines. And I got sent out to the villages a lot. And I noticed there'd be like rundown ruins of greenhouses that were built, I think, in the 70s. Were the 70s or early 80s?
Yeah, 70s. Yeah, yeah.
And you're right. And I would actually talk with who would be the grandparents. And I would go to Port Lions, and they'd be pulling the kelp out and setting it on top of the rows to plant the potatoes through. They talked about rowing out and then collecting the kelp and rowing back in and all these things. And it is like a generation skipped, not just for the villages, but probably for a lot of the world.
Yeah, and just more locally here, like in town, we've got, you know, Potato Patch Lake, which I was told that the Russian Orthodox Church used to grow like all their potatoes down there, and that it's just not really being – it's not used that like that anymore.
Maybe it's convenience foods now. Maybe that's what hit. I know in talking to old folks in Hawaii, same thing. They grew a lot of what they could, and then the fast foods hit, and – oh, it, you know, like Wonder White Bread, White Wonder Bread and all that kind of thing. So regaining that, maybe the cost of food going up, like, what, 25% in the past 5 years? So it's, I think it's more. Maybe that'll kind of force us into it.
Yeah, and we're kind of having a bit of, not only is, you know, the cost of producing food getting expensive, but the idea that, you know, there's these intermediaries that take that food and then, you know, jack the prices up so that it kind of prices out people for wholesome, good food, right? It's cheaper to buy. It's not really cheap to buy anything by any stretch of means. But it's really difficult for someone on a tight budget to really have access to organic wholesome food, like whole foods, so raw food.
Right. At the very least, yeah. I mean, let's just take the organic part off even. Yeah. It's just healthy food.
Yeah.
And here's another generation skip is cooking. So part and parcel to that, married to that, growing our own food is how many people really cook from scratch.
Yeah. You know, it's funny because, you know, selling at the farmer's market for several years, one of the biggest questions that I get is what is all this food?
Or what do I do with it?
What do I do with it? Yeah, I got to call Robbie there. Like, what do I do with that?
Yes. You know?
And so I think, you know, one of the things that, you know, that I see happening, at least in some of the farms that I work with, is that they're starting to, when they send out their food boxes or something, they're putting recipes for the ingredients in the food boxes so people have like an understanding. I know that the co-op, the lovely person that puts those boxes together is a big advocate of fennel, but you'd believe it or not, like most people don't know what to do with it.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's easy to grow here. It grows really well here inside a hoop house, but people don't know what to do with it. So they just throw it out or they don't want it. And so she's been advocating like how to use fennel in foods.
Which is absolutely brilliant.
Yeah, it is brilliant.
It is.
Yeah.
And it's I saw this shift also in seed catalogs. I like to collect old seed catalogs, and a lot of them are pretty basic, but there's this point where they want you to succeed. So they really give you a lot of information now, which is great. And it's just like the boxes of the veggies, the food boxes. To succeed, to make this whole program work, is to help people be successful.
So when we're talking about you came to Kodiak and you first started putting seeds in the ground, I'm assuming you meant that you started them in little cups or you started them inside, you said.
I started them inside,
yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So through your years, what is the method that you use that works the best?
Generally speaking, for the smaller seeds, which is a bulk of it, your kale, your lettuces, even tomatoes. I use a soil blocker, but I use the mini, the 3/4 inch, mm-hmm. and I plug out blocks and I put one seed in each one or two.
That's 3/4 inch block?
They're 3/4 inch yeah. blocks. They punch out 20 at a time. And the other way I do it is I just take like a used tofu container and I poke holes in the bottom. I fill it full of vermiculite, a little bit of compost, sifted compost, and I sprinkle them on top. and then I prick them out with a pencil and transplant them. But soil. And if you like, we can go through some like tips. And the biggest complaint I get, my seedlings are tall and leggy and they fall over when I transplant them.
Common.
It's the common. It's yeah. it's the biggest complaint. And so much of that is light. You got to give them enough light, like 16 plus 18 hours, which we don't have, you know, in the middle of the winter here. And a lot of the seeds, you know, the early ones, you want to start in February or March. And if you don't give them enough light, they're going to reach for it. And those cells actually elongate like hot dogs, you know, to reach for the light. And they get leggy and weak. Yeah, if you want stout seedlings that are going to survive being transplanted, they're like football players, like, give them enough light and you'll be halfway there.
And to kind of like piggyback on that, if they do have leggy plants, that's not the end of the world.
No, because if you're growing, say, broccoli and they're leggy, you want to bury them up to that first leaf anyway, and they'll be fine. But just watch them when you set them outside. It's important.
So after you start, not everyone has a soil blocker, but there's other ways that people can start it. They use seed trays. They go to the hardware store and get the six packs, or, you know, I bet you if you went to the nursery here that they've got used ones that they're trying to get rid of. I feel like on an island, you try to reduce the amount of plastic and stuff that you bring in.
Yeah,
so
reduce.
You try to reduce, reuse.
Uh-huh.
And
I reuse mine all the time. And that's one of the reasons I use a soil blocker is because I can sometimes I'll go to the store and I'll buy the aluminum trays for making brownies and giving away cakes. And I take the top part, the lid, and I give away the brownies and the aluminum tray. And then I plant in that, you know, I put the blocks in there.
Gotcha.
Plastic thing. And I don't use the heat mats.
Mm-hmm.
I actually will put a lot of my first sown seeds in my living room, but as soon as they germinate, they get the light treatment, you know, totally light treatment. And I also don't use sterile mixes. That's recent science has come up with the fact that seeds, yes, they have the food inside, but they need that real nutrients, the real organics, for their whole young life. They need to be exposed to that at the onset. Because one thing is that there is no such thing as a sterile soil.
I was very confused when you said sterile soil. I was looking at you with wide eyes.
Yeah, because there's no such thing as sterile soil. It's just like there's no such thing as a purely sterile instrument in an emergency operating room. It just doesn't exist. So you want it to not be sterile. You want to have a little bit of organics in there. And I learned this from Jeff Lowenfels, the writer. He's got the longest running gardening column, I think, in North America. It's amazing. Mm-hmm. And I interviewed him once. I said, so Jeff, what is the best seed starting and growing mixture? He says, gotta have compost in it. Live compost. And he said, it's a little bit like kids that have this peanut allergy or a similar allergy that he says, none of us grew up knowing anybody that had a peanut allergy. But you need to expose the kids to, as they're growing up, to different things to create this healthy biome. I said, you mean like your gut? He says, absolutely. Plants, young plants, seedlings, they all need a healthy biome, so to speak, or healthy soil. Yeah.
Yeah, I know that we don't, like me personally at our farm, we use potting mix to start all of our starts we also soil block. But what we do before we transplant or when we want to like do a quick fertilizing, because the potting mix only is really good for like the nutrition, the nutrients are only good for about 4 to 6 weeks.
If that.
And so what we do is that we take compost tea.
Mm-hmm.
And so we'll just take a scoop of compost that we're working on. I don't really care if it's like broken down completely or not. We just stick it in like a bag, and we put it in water for 24 hours. We add a little bit of sugar in there to feed the good bacteria. And then what we'll do is that before we transplant, or right like the day before, we'll water everything with that. And that way they've got like an inoculant, I think.
Yeah, it's a good way to think of it.
Yeah, yeah. I know that's like looking at the research, like it's vague. It's kind of arm waving, at least the research. But it makes me feel good.
Well, yeah. Oh, you mean the arm waving? Yeah, there's a lot of arm waving around compost tea in general. Yeah, I go, well, you know, observe what's going on in your garden or your farm. If it works, great.
I think like the takeaway is that it doesn't hurt. I've never seen a paper that says it causes problems.
Yeah.
So at the very least, it may just be time consumption that is like, but it makes me feel good.
Well, and you brought up a really good point. It's a little bit like hydroponic feeding, what I do with my indoor plants now. I don't use compost. I used to in my indoor plant mix because it brings in too many bugs.
Yeah.
However, what I do is I'll do a fairly sterile mix, like potting soil that might not have much in it, and I make my own tea out of comfrey and compost, and I run it through a filter, and then I bring it in. It's got the nutrients, and it works that way too. Yeah.
Yeah, I think the most important thing is just to make sure that the stuff that you're using has some living material in it.
It's got to have the living material in it. Yeah. Right.
And I always just appreciate the bags that say, "Oh, this has got mycorrhizae in the soil." It's like, well, you can go kick a rock over, and it's got mycorrhizae. As sort of like a gimmick. And I feel like soil companies and gardening companies really prey off of newbies, new people coming to it, because they're just so overwhelmed with all this like information. And it's really, the marketing is really hard sometimes for people to get over. So,
it's really hard, and the messages that people get on the internet. And it's so confusing, and that's why I run a seed starting course every year, because people are overwhelmed. They go, I don't even know where to start. I don't know if I'm doing anything, and they're afraid of doing something wrong.
Yeah, that's the thing. And my response to that is that the way to become a better grower is on the road paved with lots of dead plants. So
that's how you learn.
Yeah, you got to figure
it
out.
Like my seedlings.
Yeah. You know, and even the professional growers. You know, they have problems. They deal with it. They learn from it. But I think the act of doing is kind of like just getting over that threshold to being successful down the road.
To honestly just do it. I mean, there isn't a successful businessman, woman in the world that hasn't fallen on their face.
It's true.
You know, if you don't have these challenges, I mean, you got to have friction. It's like a pearl inside of an oyster. Unless there's friction, that little grain of sand isn't going to grow.
Yeah.
You got to have that. Otherwise, you become like a spiritual cream puff, you know? You just do. You've got to have these challenges and take that challenge as, what can I learn from this?
Yeah.
Always ask, what can I learn from this? Don't give up. Yeah.
And I think that's like people, they try it and they don't succeed. And then they get overwhelmed and they're just like, oh, I've just wasted all this time, all this energy, all this money, and I've got nothing to show for it. And, you know, when I first started growing, that was a huge mindset to work over. It's like, well, this is a setback, but, you know, I've learned a whole lot. And from this experience, that's going to propel me into the next year. Like, not every year that we grow is always going to be a banger. You know,
right? It's, or a crop might not be.
Yeah. You know, and you could be doing something. Even for professionals, get hung up on this is like you've been growing broccoli for 10, 15 years the same way, and it's perfect every single year, except this one year something dramatically happened, and you know, it could be disheartening.
Well, actually, you know, I order some of my seeds from Johnny's Seeds. I actually order from about, I don't know, 8 catalogs plus local.
Yeah, we'll
here.
Get into that.
But I remember when I read in the catalog and they go crop failure, I go, dang, it happens to them too.
Yeah. And I think that's kind of like when you're coming to it and you're not having success, I think that it can be a bit overwhelming at times.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. And go online and try to look it up, and you've
that
got
is insane, million, isn't it?
A million different answers, yeah. And so you end up hitting your head against the wall, not knowing where to go.
Yeah,
and,
or you try to do like everything, like you just try to do every solution,
troubleshoot
and just,
everything, yeah, and then nothing and works
nothing
because
works.
Of that.
Yeah. I find when people come to me with solution or with a problem, it's very like, oh, I read on the internet. Oh, I read somewhere that this is what that is. Oh, I read that, and it's like, well. That could possibly be a problem, but let's like, you know, like recently we had one person that had a total crop failure of all across. And they were convinced that it was fungal, like it was a fungal thing. And I was like, well, I don't know why you thought it would be fungal. Well, because I read it somewhere that's, you know, that's what it caused. And it's like, well, if it's directed on like one particular family or one particular species, then I would say, sure, you might have a problem. But across the board, that's probably more of like a soil problem than anything else.
I usually start with the soil too.
I always start with the soil. 99.9% of the problems can be solved with the soil. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are certain like, you know, there are certain instances where it is like definitely not the soil, but
so here's an interesting thing on that. We tend to focus on the top part of the plant.
Yeah.
And years ago, when I was teaching organic gardening at Kodiak College, the first night I would set at everybody's place a blank sheet of paper and some color crayons and pencils and markers, and everybody would be sitting down. They have their coffees or whatever, and I say, okay. For the next 5 minutes, I want you to draw a plant. Hmm. And there's daisies and there's broccoli and there's some people put in houses and sunshine and clouds and trees and all that. Not one person would draw the roots. Hmm. So we're so top-headed, you know, maybe in our minds, our brains too, but we're all about the end result. But it's really, it's that foundation, the base, the soil.
Yeah. One of the adages that I was taught is that if you feed the soil, the plants take care of themselves.
Yeah, you feed the soil, you feed the plants.
Feed the plants. Mm-hmm. So you've got your seeds, you've got them started. What kind of developmental road signs would you say for people to like be okay? They're doing great. They're like they're thriving. They're doing great. When should I put them out in the garden?
Or pot them up.
Or pot them up.
Okay,
yeah.
Pot them up to the next size container. My first clue is when they get their second set of leaves, pretty much. And that's called their true leaves. The first set, their seedling set, like your brassicas, your broccolis, and cauliflowers, they all look the same, which I think are beautiful because they look like hearts.
They look like little heart cotyledons, aren't they?
Yeah, they're just delightful. And so, but the second one goes, hey, this is what I am. Look at me. And so when they develop those, then I transplant them. But not before. I usually, as silly as it might sound, I give them a little heads up. Okay, you guys, I'm coming in tomorrow. This is what we're going to do. Whatever you got to do to get ready, this is what we're going to do.
That's civil of you.
And then I get the containers ready next. And the other thing I learned is, you know, it's going to take a more beefier soil at this point because they're really growing, right? And I also don't keep them in a warm environment. You know, lettuce, you grow them in a warm living room, in your kitchen. Even though they're under lights, they're going to be wimpy. We're talking about cool crops here.
Yeah, they don't really like it above 70 degrees.
No.
The lettuce doesn't, yeah.
Nope. Yeah. And so they're transplanted and they go under lights. I mean, I use lights that you should have about a hand's width if you're a horse person. It's a hand like 4 inches or 3 inches above the tops of the seedlings. So you can either raise the lights as they grow or you can lower your floor. But you also need to know, because there's so many different kinds of lights out there and for, you know, all that, you need to read the instructions. Because some lights, you should be 20 inches above the tops because they're so intense. But you got to maintain that light. What do you do? I do 16 hours a day. 18.
Yeah, it's about right. Once they start germinating, it's about 14 to 16 hours mm-hmm. a day. And usually, like, by the – because I usually try to leave them in there about 6 weeks. Because we do inch and a half or 2-inch blocks. They have a little bit of time to stand there.
Yes.
And I find that 6 weeks is about to the mark that they're just like, we're done. We want to go out.
Time to go out.
Yeah, time to go out. By that time, like, we'll start at 16 in the beginning, and then we'll taper it down to about 14 about the last week or two. Mm-hmm. And then I find that certain plants need to be hardened off more than others.
Yes.
But with the soil blocks, I haven't really found too many that need to do that. So we can just put them out, and I almost get to no transplant shock.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is great, and you probably have good root systems too.
Yeah, yeah. And with the soil blocks, one of the reasons why I went with the soil blocks is because they air prune. And for the listeners out there, with air pruning,
now this is cool. You guys, listen up.
Is that when the roots get to the edge of the block, there's not like a plastic thing that holds them down. So you don't, like, when you think about when you pop your seedling out from a six pack from the local nursery, you notice that all the roots are spiraled around the soil. Well, with the soil block, you don't get that. They basically get to the edge of the soil block, and they're just like, there's air. We're just going to stop right there.
Right.
But they don't – so they don't get root bound. Mm-hmm. That's the idea, is that air pruning prevents the roots getting root bound. Will they grow into the other blocks? Sure, they do that, but it's not really a problem when you break them apart and plop them in the ground. It just seems for me – A lot easier on the plants. It's certainly not less expensive, but
no, time consuming.
It's very time consuming, and either I recommend soil blocks if you're only doing just a few or a whole lot. But like that in between, maybe the seed trays might be a better word. Mm-hmm. And there's actually new seed trays out there that people can look into called Windstrips, and it's basically a seed tray setup. You can do it. They've got them, I think, in 10-20 tray size that do the same thing, but they're just plugs, and so they air prune in the plugs.
Oh, okay.
And they're like, they're kind of a bit spendy. They're like $12
but they last a while.
They last forever.
Yeah,
they last forever. And that's kind of like the in between that I find that people use sometimes. Mm-hmm. They don't, if it's too costly or too time consuming. So a lot of commercial growers will use the Windstrips rather than the soil blocks.
Okay, that would make sense.
Yeah, yeah, because they've got like a thing, and then, you know, they've got all kinds of fancy tools that you can do for seed starting. And so I try to make sure that people don't, like, get lost into, like, the commercial side of things, because I think that's, like, overplayed.
It is overplayed. There's a lot of things you really don't need.
Yeah.
But if you just focus on what the plant needs, then it gets down to it.
I think I started with, when we moved to Kodiak, we started out with using newspaper.
Oh, the newspaper rolls.
Yep. Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. We used newspaper. I remember us collecting also toilet paper rolls,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
using those. And so there's lots of, like, if you're trying to do it on you know, try to be judicious with your pocketbook, there's lots of ways that you can do it without having to go and buy a bunch of stuff.
Right. And one thing in particular are those pressed wafers with the mesh around the outside, you know, you add water, they
poof up. They poof up, yeah.
Yes, but for the most part, our cool soils, that mesh does not break down.
Not very well.
No.
Not very well, mm-hmm. Yeah. So another question that I get a lot that after you start them is the temperatures.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what temperature do I keep my plants at?
Are you talking about indoors still?
Indoors, yeah.
Well, once they germinate, which can be in a warm space, then I put them in. Like, our garage is maybe 55 to 60. And for the majority of my crops, that's what they like. Now, tomatoes might be a little different. I mean, they still like a little coolish. But also is the timing. When do I start my seeds?
That is a time-honored tradition.
Time-honored tradition. That's a good one.
Yeah.
And a lot of it is, okay, pick the point at which you're going to transplant them outside, either in your hoop house, your greenhouse, or your raised beds, and you count back from there.
Yep.
And that information is really on your seed packet. Now, when I first moved to Kodiak and thought about growing something, the locals would say, oh, we never put anything outside before Memorial Day, the end of May. But then there was not a whole lot of playing around with hoop houses and mini hoops and all of that. And so I can kind of understand that. But I've been able to push the envelope way back where, here's an example, and not everything is grown and started indoors.
That's true.
Yes.
And we can get into that, too.
Yeah. Do you want to do that now? Or I can mention one thing I do is, well, going back, I used to be an avid reader of Mother Earth News. I mean, avid reader. And I would follow Helen and Scott Nearing's column.
Oh, the
Back
Nearings.
To the Landers in Vermont and then Maine. And one year, I mean, they'd built this beautiful greenhouse, so much stonework. It was amazing. And one year in late fall, the Weather Service was calling for a really hard freeze. And they had a really hard decision to make. They had a lot of greens in the greenhouse. And so what do? Do we water them or do we keep them dry? What do we do with this freeze coming? Because, you know, the citrus growers, they would mist the trees.
Yeah, it has to be a consistent mist.
It has to be. And so they decided to do an experiment, which I love it when people do experiments. It's not all or nothing. They do half and half. So half the greenhouse they sprayed, watered. The other half they let dry. So what do you think happened? Which ones survived?
Oh, the dry ones. Oh, the wet ones. The wet ones did. The dry ones did?
Yes.
Huh.
Because the hard freeze, the cells, the water-filled cells in the plants, lysed. They burst like balloons. The dry ones, while they wilted a little, they sprang back. So here I am in Kodiak. I'm going, wow, that sounds pretty cool. I wonder if I could try that. So I had been playing with mini hoops then. This is 40 plus years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty flimsy plastic, but it worked. I thought, I'm going to try this. So I built two rows in this little 4x8 raised bed, and I transplanted out in October these 3-inch tall lettuce seedlings. And then I covered them with plastic, and I put rocks all around and clips and whatever I could do to keep everything all sealed in. And I didn't open it for like 5 months, 4 months. And I put out 20 and 13 of them survived. I didn't water and we had everything. We had snow, we had freezing and they looked a little wimpy at first, but 13 of them sprang back and kept growing. So this time, fast forward 40 years, now I do a variation of that with spinach is I sow spinach seeds during the first week of September and they grow about 2 inches, 3 inches. Then they're covered. I mulch them really well around them, and I cover them. And they might get all kind of flattened to the ground. But I know what keeps them going are the roots. They have their roots established. So when the day length in February pops above 10 hours, like around the 20th or so, they start growing again. And I can be harvesting spinach leaves until early June.
Yeah.
Early June. The stalk is almost as big around as my wrist. And, you know, they're not the most tender spinach leaves by the end of May or so. But we're eating. We're eating on them. So that's another experiment thing. Just try it. What's the worst thing that happens? It goes in the compost pile.
It's true. I wanted to nickname my farm Rough Draft Farm. but that one was already taken. Someone beat me to it. They're a little bit more clever than I was. Because we do – I like to do very strange experiments at the garden, at our farm. The way that I look at it is like I'm going to do this. I'm going to dedicate to this one little spot just so I can see what would happen. So – because you never know. Like we do our varietal checks. Like we do different varieties. We grow things in different conditions. And we are also trying to be like, well, let's see if we can eke out this plant that's not necessarily supposed to do well up here, but we're going to try it anyways.
Try it anyway.
Yeah. So,
which is really, you know, I learned something along those lines because you're trialing. It's called trialing. And Renee Shepherd of Renee's Seeds, Renee's Garden down in California, she's a friend of mine and we talk pretty frequently. And I said, so what kind of advice would you give someone who's, you know, wanting to buy some seeds, right? Whether it's from you, Renee, or, you know. Victory Seeds or whatever. She says, your best bet is to go with a seed company where they trial their seeds.
Yeah.
They actually grow them out, see what they do, and they're not just buying factory held seeds and then putting them in little packets and sending them out to you. Yeah.
You could always tell, like, the quality of the seed company that packages those, because they will give you certain information on those seeds, right? So they're going to give you when to sow them inside or out. They're going to tell you when the seed date is processed.
Special requirements.
Yep, yep. Yep. And so I always appreciate that. But not all seed companies do that.
No.
So
that's what I was saying. By the way, you want to figure out when you want to set them out, and then you count back from there. If it's 6 to 8 weeks for broccoli or something, then that's on your calendar. You know when to start them.
Yep. So, like you had touched, you had mentioned earlier, like the difference between growing them inside and outside. What do you find that works for outside here for Kodakians?
Oh, for what to grow outside?
Oh, well, just like to sow the seeds.
Oh, for yeah. sowing seeds? Yeah, yeah. Lots of times I'll sow a mixture of salad greens and then, or a cluster of lettuce mixed, and I'll pluck them out and then grow them as individual plants and as what I call a cut and come again, you know, like the gourmet greens you get in the bags in the grocery store. Mm-hmm. They're so easy to grow here. Another thing I do along those lines is I will... start potatoes in tubs or even in the ground, either way. And while I'm waiting for those potato shoots to pop up, I will sow greens on top. So in halibut tubs, I put my like 4 inches of soil, put the potatoes on top, fill it with kelp and all that kind of stuff, top it off with some nice sifted compost, and I put seeds of greens on top. And I can get sometimes 3 cuttings before those potatoes come through. So for somebody that's got like limited space, yeah. you get a 2-for-1 there.
Yeah, and in Kodiak we have a very limited space.
Yes.
Most people don't have the luxury of having large open spaces here. What vegetables or what plants do you find do better being sown directly outside versus being sown directly like inside?
Right.
Because there's also, like, not everything is like great to be transplanted, right?
Not everything's yeah. great to be yeah. transplanted, that's for sure. Most yeah. of those are your root crops. You know, your turnips, your rutabagas, your carrots. And there's not everything likes a hoop house or a greenhouse either. Your alliums, I found for me, could be my location, but they like outside. Hmm. Brussels sprouts, they like to be grown outside. Tomatoes inside in the hoop or, you know, peas outside. I do start beans beforehand, and a lot of sources say, oh, no, direct sow those. But if you take enough soil with the root, with the plant, you're really careful, you can do it. You can do it. What have you found?
Well, at our farm, we hand sow, I shouldn't say hand sow, we direct sow into the soil. The only things that we do are radishes, parsnips,
yep.
and carrots. Everything else we soil block.
Mm-hmm.
So our Hukari turnips, our beets, our rutabagas, our onions, everything else, like we use soil blocks. The other thing that we don't directly put into a soil block is garlic, obviously.
Yeah, garlic.
Yeah, yeah. You can't put garlic in a soil mm-mm, block. Mm-mm. At least I've never seen someone do it. So if there's anyone out there that has experimented, let me know. I don't know what benefits that would be, but.
Well, speaking of garlic, it's another case of how you can get a 2-for-1 crop.
It is, yeah.
Because I used to sow my garlic bulbs, plant them in September. Oh, I don't know, 6 inches apart. I don't know. And now I plant them a good 8 inches apart, leaving space for the spring when the garlic is now, I don't know, 3 inches tall.
Mm-hmm.
And this is one of the few times I purchase seed tape. I'll get seed tape of carrots,
mm-hmm.
and I'll run that seed tape in between the garlic rows. First time I did this, I went, I don't know if this is going to work because we kind of have two sort of root crops here. I don't know. But the root system for a carrot is not ginormous. And they're young enough where when I pull the garlic out in July or whenever it's calling, it does not disturb the carrots too badly. And it's a charm. It works like a charm. And now I've got a new raised bed of really happy carrots.
Brilliant.
Yeah, it works.
I'm glad that you talked about C-tape. I was just one of my other points was so one of the comments that I get is that starting seeds takes too long. It's too much space. I don't have the time to start, but I still want to. I still want to have stuff in the garden, and it comes to this crossroads of what are the benefits of starting my own versus going to the nursery and buying the starts already started.
It's a really good question because you wonder. I don't have time, and I'll say that rooted. We don't realize when you have a nursery that will grow what works here. It's so unusual these days to have an independent nursery that does that. Having said that, one of the main reasons that I like to grow my own starts, my seedlings from seed, is the variety. I can choose from an unlimited variety that I particularly like. Like if I, if you want to have a specific kind of tomato that you're going to know you're going to turn it all into paste or something, then you can have a huge variety. I think that's a lot of it. And I can control when I'm going to start them and when I'm going to set them out, because I set them out so much earlier than most people. This whole thing about frost-free date, you can just throw that out the window. I think that is like the biggest farce ever, because it's so variable and it's not about the frost. It's about protecting your plant, the soil temp. I mean, because all of our raised beds now are covered with mini hoops, I don't come into March with frozen blocks of soil. They're all friable. In other words, that means I can stick my hand in it any time of the year, and it's fluffy. And so it has good tilth. And so I can transplant seedlings out without having to get hair dryers out to thaw out my soil. And so I like to have that variety of, I can start these seeds whenever I want. I can stagger it every 2 weeks if I want. So I am in control, and I really like that.
Mm-hmm. I also find it cheaper. It's very cheaper.
If I have too many seeds, do a seed swap.
Yeah.
Share, hey, I got all these onions. Let's get together, have tea, and let's swap some seeds.
But it's like more common practice now with even with big growers to like source that their tomatoes or their brassicas and stuff. They're looking at it as like a labor short.
It is a little bit of that. Yeah. It also has its downsides. It was like maybe 7 years ago or so, there was this catastrophe with tomato seedlings up and down the whole eastern seaboard. Because a lot of the tomatoes are started in Florida and places like that. And then they send out, if you will, ship the seedlings depending on how the spring is advancing, starting with the South and then the Carolinas and da-da-da-da. Well, the seed stock, if you will, in the initial growing company had some sort of fungus or something. And so the entire blight, so the entire eastern seaboard suffered, the tomatoes, from the same blight that purchased from the original growers. It was like talk about crop failure.
Yeah. That really plays hard into variety and diversity in seed companies. That's definitely. So another thing that I wanted to get into is for Kodiak, land is a bit sparse, and most people don't have large growing spaces to do these. But that necessarily doesn't have to make their growing experience any less, right?
Correct.
And so one of the things that that is getting really popular, because we're getting into these very deeply urban areas, that land is very their land ability to use is very small. It's like a very small footprint when we think about like downtown Seattle or Chicago or stuff. But when I visit these areas, I'm always shocked at what people do with their small little front yards. And it seems to be they're digging out their grass lawns from
Amen.
That's been perpetrated since the 50s. And they're doing some of the things that's like really popular right now is compact gardening or square foot gardening. Mm-hmm. I was wondering if you could talk about your footprint is relatively small, mm-hmm. and you grow a variety of things. And so maybe if you can explain what maybe that mindset is of square foot gardening and why it's so popular.
Are you talking literally like, is it Bartholomew? The person that sort of,
yeah,
so this whole square foot thing?
Yeah, but Dowding did it as well.
Charles Dowding,
yeah,
yes.
Yeah, yeah.
But mostly it's trying to get the most out of the smallest amount of space.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's, for me, is where really raised beds come out. Now, I'm not talking about just the mounds, which if you have the space, it's great. But for me, it's having edges.
Yeah.
It's like what they do in Italy. They've got gardens along railroad tracks, right? Something comes out, something goes in. So it just takes a little planning. You know, you can get multiple crops of things. You don't have to just sow in the spring and then fall and that's it. It's a one crop deal. No, you can have broccoli growing and another row of salad greens growing up. Just sow next to it, broccoli comes out, and then these keep growing. So, and halibut tubs. You want to be a millionaire is trying to figure out how to market halibut tubs to the rest of the world for the best frickin' planter in the world. But, you know, use the space you got. It could be along your driveway. It could be on your deck. Again, something comes out, something goes in. Grow vertical and grow bunching. You know, I found that my favorite zucchini, the Easy Pick Gold 2 or something that they were using or growing in the middle school greenhouse. I'm now practicing with actually growing that vertically. Whoever heard of a vertical zucchini, just try it. You know, we can't really do the three sisters here, you know, the corn, the beans, and the squash, but we can do variations of that. You know, in my hoop house, I've got thornless blackberries. They're vertical. Hanging baskets. They don't have to be just for flowers. Grow some veg. And a lot of people are doing hydroponics indoors. You know, let your imagination grow wild and just keep playing with it.
I think you touched on a couple of things. I can put some words to them, but it seems like you're talking about companion versus interplanting versus successional planting, right?
Yes, so I do a whole variety of those.
Yeah. So successional planting is when you're constantly planting something after the crop is done.
Like right.
You pull one crop in, you put one crop mm-hmm. in. Interplanting is when you're planting two crops that are not necessarily they don't necessarily have synergistic relationship, but they do grow well together.
They grow well together. Yeah, yeah. One might be a root and one might be a top of. And the other thing I tried experimenting with was I would put hills in my raised beds. So I'd grow like celery in the valleys because they really like a lot of moisture, and I'd put salad greens on the top. So that's kind of compressing it, kind of like wrinkling it together too.
Yeah, we do scallions, or what you guys call bunching onions.
Bunching onions, green onions.
With lettuce. So we'll go down to, you know, because lettuce has, you know, it's like we do 5-inch spacing, and we'll just do rows and rows. So basically like that one bed, we get two crops at a time.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
And also, like what we have is for flower boxes. I have all kinds of other veggies in there, in amongst the flowers. So they're beautiful. So what might be considered a landscaped area, I put all kinds of other vegetables in there. I had kale next to my rhododendrons. I just put them in there. See how they do.
And then companion planting is obviously there's a synergistic relationship, right? You plant marigolds next to your plants so that there's some sort of pest control or what's not. And I always just tell people, you know, don't get caught up on like the language.
Mm-hmm.
Focus on the goal of just getting things in the ground.
Just the practicality of it.
Yeah. But not, you know, when we think about compact gardening or square foot gardening or grown in small spaces,
mm-hmm.
Not everything plays well, right? When you're talking about, like, you got to kind of think about your space that you've got, you know, you're not going to be able in like a 4-foot by 4-foot bed have, you know, 10 broccoli plants.
Right.
Yeah. So you just kind of have to think about what you're growing in that space, what you want to grow. Mm-hmm. And they're just like, well, what does best? And I was like, what do you like to eat the best?
Like, right. What do you like to eat? What do you want to learn to eat? You know, and there's heavy feeders.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like we have Brussels sprouts, and I still have Brussels sprouts in 5 gallon buckets in my greenhouse because I needed to lift them in order to plant my garlic. So I had to kind of get out of this box thinking that clear out of bed, put the garlic in. I went, yeah, but these plants are doing great. Now what do I do? So I just dig them up, put them in 5 gallon buckets. I had holes in them. Who doesn't have a 5 gallon bucket that has holes? And now they're happy. I've got Brussels sprouts like softballs in my greenhouse. But the Brussels sprouts in the garden, they are heavy feeders. They take a lot. So I'm not going to put a heavy feeder next to a heavy feeder. And most of the brassicas are basically heavy feeders.
And what we mean by heavy feeders, they eat a lot of nitrogen.
They eat a lot of nitrogen. Yeah. They eat a lot of that, right? It's like a teenager in a refrigerator. They're heavy feeders, right? So that kind of competition to think about. And the tallness. You know, put your tall plants in the back. Your peas, your beans, your, you know, it's so funny. You read a seed pack and they go, oh, they grow to 3 feet tall. I don't think so. These guys are 6 foot beans and they're going on to 8 feet. Like,
I read that on the seed packets for my sugar snap peas. They're just like, oh, these are Oregon sugar snap. They're supposed to be 2 feet tall. And it's like, I've got an 8 foot trellis and they're reaching the top already. Like, you know, so we've been sitting here talking for almost a bloody hour here. One of the things that
Get me a coffee. I'm ready. I'm ready to go. Yeah.
One of the things that I deal with a lot with the public with my job at Kodiak Soil and Water is dealing with like people's challenges and like they're new to Kodiak. They're trying to grow stuff and they haven't really had so much success. What are the challenges that you find the most here? What are the biggest challenges for you?
You mean when I was starting out or just talking to people?
Well, in general, I mean, we still have challenges like the weather and...
Oh, impatience.
You know, yeah, impatience is a big one, isn't it?
It is. Yeah. It's impatience and the need for perfection.
Yeah.
You know, plants don't care if you have a bad hair day. And you just try your best and there's next year. It's okay. And I just, it's really a mindset thing. It's okay. Something messes up, screws up, don't worry about it. Next, you know, have some extra seeds available. Go ahead. You got a hole where your turnips didn't work. Maybe the root maggots got to them. They're pretty ugly and gross. Hey, sow some lettuce. Learn from it. How can I prevent that next time? Be curious. And I mean be curious as in not after the fact, but, you know, when I'm out in the garden, and it almost makes me cry to think about this, but if I see a plant that's kind of not quite right, I go mentally or maybe verbally, I go, what can I do to help you? You know, that whole intuition as in just be calm, just be still, and lots of times you'll get an answer. It's not going to be like English or Latin coming into your head. It might be just a sense. Oh, maybe I should try some compost tea or something. Or maybe there is a bug problem. Let me go get my little magnifying glass and check this out. It can be as subtle as that. So just be curious and ask, so what if, like experimenting, or what can I do to help, or what do you need? Sometimes all the answers are right there.
It's great advice.
It works. Yeah.
Well, I don't have anything else to on my sheet here. Is there anything that you want to...
Let me just add one thing. We're talking about seeds, and the other problem that people have is my seedlings get 2 inches taller, and then they fall over.
Yeah.
And if you get on the internet, a million bazillion sources will tell you damping off is what it's called. I don't know who gave it that name. It's bizarre. But damping off is caused by non-sterile soil, and it's not. And it's by the lack of air circulation. So here's an example. If you plant your seeds in, say, plastic cups, which is great, you're reusing plastic cups, but their soil level is down an inch below, you know, freeboard, we call it on a boat, but it's down an inch. So you got a dead zone. And you need to have good air circulation across the soil, because that which causes damping off is in all soil. And I got a firm validation on this, because I've been preaching this for years. Air circulation is, I did a little YouTube short about the truth about damping off disease. And a few months later, I got a message from a grower in like Argentina. I think it was one of the South American countries. He was a professional grower of certain trees, had seedlings. He said, "Thank you. I've been trying for years to prevent these starts from dying. And I put up fans and I did all this and it worked. I just want to tell you that." So so there's a lot out there. Try not to be overwhelmed. Relax, be curious, and accept failures as an opportunity to grow and learn something. Absolutely.
Where can people find you?
My YouTube channel is The Upbeat Gardener, with two E's. I have a dancing beat for my logo. Okay, go figure. The Upbeat Gardener, I write a weekly gardening column for the past almost 30 years for the Kodiak Daily Mirror. And my email address, you're welcome to email me, is mygarden@alaska.net.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Thank you so much, Marian, for coming in.
My pleasure.
Listen to all the episodes of Talks Around a Farm Table on KMXT.org and Spotify. This show is in collaboration between Kodiak Soil and Water Conservation District and KMXT Radio. You can find me, Ian Zacher, on Facebook at Kodiak Soil and Water Conservation District or on the web at www.kodiaksoilandwater.org. Music featured in this episode is Boil the Breakfast by The Chieftains, which is my son's favorite song.